normally would give a jobs report. The government shutdown means it's not coming out, even though economic data is especially important right now. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump told Congress the country is in, quote, armed conflict with drug cartels. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. As we will hear, a national security lawyer uses a very different term to describe U.S. attacks on boats in the Caribbean. Also, Sean Combs is about to be sentenced on two prostitution-related charges. How will the judge respond to his request for a second chance? It's Friday, October 3rd. This day in 2023, Kevin McCarthy became the first Speaker of the House of Representatives to be removed by a vote of his colleagues. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. It's the third day of the government shutdown, and so far, there's no end in sight. Senators will take another vote today for the fourth time on partisan stopgap bills that have failed to win enough support to fund the government and end the shutdown. Democrats say Republicans could have avoided this with concessions on health care. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
The overwhelming majority of Democrats are standing firm because we recognize that the healthcare crisis is not looming, it is upon us. Republicans have already enacted the largest cut to Medicaid in American history. That was part of their one big ugly bill. Hospitals and nursing homes and community-based health clinics are closing because of Republican malignant action.
Speaking there to NPR's All Things Considered. But President Trump blames Democrats and is threatening to permanently cut thousands of federal jobs. The White House is asking a handful of colleges to sign a deal that they say will uphold administration priorities on topics ranging from diversity to ideological values in order to get preferential access to federal funds. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny has more.
The Trump administration sent a letter to multiple colleges requesting they commit to things like viewpoint diversity, free speech, and rooting out what the administration says is, quote, anti-Semitic and illegal behavior on college campuses. In response to the memo, the chairman of the University of Texas System Board of Regents said in a statement, the system was honored that its flagship campus was chosen, and quote, we welcome the new opportunity to working with the Trump administration on it. This latest attempt at a compact comes after the Trump administration canceled or threatened to cut federal funding for universities over a number of issues, including transgender policies, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and anti-Semitism. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
In Germany, Munich Airport was forced to close for nearly 7 hours overnight after a wave of drone sightings nearby. As NPR's Rob Schmitz reports, it's the latest airport in Europe to shut down over unexplained drone flights.
The airport said in a statement that at least 17 flights were grounded overnight, impacting 3,000 passengers, while airport officials diverted 15 additional flights to other airports in the region. The airport reopened at 5 in the morning local time when arrivals and departures were again deemed safe. Munich is not alone. Last week, several airports in Denmark were forced to close for the same reason. Denmark later banned all civil drones as it hosted a summit of European leaders to discuss support for Ukraine as well as a potential drone wall initiative, a layered network of interception systems. Europe has been on alert due to a string of sightings and incursions by Russian drones into NATO airspace. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The founding pastor of a Texas megachurch has pleaded guilty to 5 counts of child sexual abuse. As Penelope Rivera from member station KERA reports, the allegations date back to the 1980s.
Robert Morris started Gateway Church in 2000 and built it into one of the largest congregations in the country. Following his guilty plea, he was given a 10-year sentence, but will only serve 6 months in jail in Oklahoma, where the abuse took place. He will also be required to register as a lifetime sex offender and pay $270,000 to the victim, Cindy Clemeshire. Clemeshire went public about the abuse she endured from Morris in June of 2024. Since then, Gateway has faced a drop in attendance and donations and multiple lawsuits. Clemeshire said the abuse started when she was 12 and lasted more than 4 years. For NPR News, I'm Penelope Rivera in Dallas.
Victim impact statements will be heard today in a New York courtroom. before Sean Diddy Combs is scheduled to be sentenced in a criminal case that could put him in prison for years. The hip-hop mogul was convicted in July after an 8-week trial on prostitution-related charges, but he was acquitted of the more serious racketeering, conspiracy, and sex trafficking charges. Yesterday, Combs made a plea for leniency in a letter to a federal judge, saying he was humbled by the criminal case and wouldn't commit another crime. Prosecutors say he should spend more than 11 years in prison. His lawyers, though, want him freed based on time served. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Focus Features, Presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters today. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
October 5th, 1982. John Bream had been covering music for Minneapolis's Star Tribune for nearly a decade. Lots of rock and pop stories, hard touring bands, solo artists with something to prove. But he'd never seen any group quite like the one piling into the Hyatt Regency hotel room and digging into room service trays of triple-decker sandwiches, fries, and chili. The group consisted of five bandmates, and every one of them was a woman. They were the Go-Go's, the first all-female rock group to write their own songs, play their own instruments, and score a number one album. Bream was interviewing them in advance of their concert that night at the Met Center. "Just don't say we're giggly," the band's rhythm guitarist told the music critic. The Go-Go's were tired of being marginalized and dismissed by the press just because they were women. Bream eventually titled his article, "Being on the Go-Go Isn't Easy," and years later, in 2021, would be among the voters that inducted the Go-Go's into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. For economists who follow the job market, the first Friday of the month is like Christmas morning. That's when the Labor Department usually delivers its report on jobs and unemployment. But all economists got this morning was a lump of coal. The report has been postponed by the government shutdown. NPR Scott Horsley reports.
If this were a typical Jobs Friday, Daniel Zhao would be sitting by his computer at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time, eagerly waiting for the Labor Department's monthly report.
Jobs report is every labor economist's favorite time of the month.
But Zhao, who's chief economist at the job search website Glassdoor, will be empty-handed this morning. The Labor Department has furloughed its number crunchers due to the government shutdown, so there will be no market-moving jobs tally today. Allison Srivastav, who's an economist with the Indeed job listing site, doesn't know what she's going to do with herself.
It's going to be very odd to not be refreshing, refreshing, refreshing. I guess I'll just slowly sip my coffee. I'm not sure. Take the dog for an extra long walk.
Today's report was expected to show that employers added about 50,000 jobs in September. That would be a pickup from the 22,000 jobs added the previous month, but a big slowdown compared to the 240,000 jobs added this time last year. University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson says some of that slowdown is inevitable, given the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented immigrants.
I think everybody agrees that it's not the kind of job growth we had a year ago. We can't sustain job growth that's that quick and get rid of a lot of our foreign-born workers.
Beyond the headline-grabbing jobs number, the monthly report packs a wealth of information about who's moving in and out of the workforce and which industries are hiring or cutting back. As job growth has slowed in recent months, many of the gains have been concentrated in healthcare, which tends to be insulated from the ups and downs of the broader economy. Srivastav says while there haven't been a lot of layoffs, it's been a tough time for anyone trying to land a first job.
Because there's been so much uncertainty, I think everybody, employers and job seekers alike, are kind of just holding their breath and trying to hold out for as long as they can to make a kind of a decision.
Anyone hoping for clues in the jobs report today is out of luck. For now, businesses and policymakers just have to make their best guesses about which way the economy is going. That would be hard enough if it were coasting on a steady course. Stevenson says it's more challenging at a moment of transition.
We're in a time where the economy's changing, and that makes data more valuable than it is in a regular time.
It's like we're driving on a winding road on a foggy night, and our headlights and GPS just conked out. To be sure, there are other sources of information about the labor market. Payroll processors, job search websites, the guy at the barbershop who seems to know everything. But economists agree there's no substitute for the reach of the federal government's number crunchers, even if the Trump administration has cut their staffing and fired the commissioner who used to oversee the jobs report.
There's no making up for a survey that captures tens of millions of employees. There's nothing that is close to that.
Stevenson notes at least the September jobs information had already been collected, and it will be released once the government shutdown is over. But the government has also stopped collecting information for future reports, including the September inflation tally. And the longer the shutdown drags on, the harder it will be to catch up. Zhao is hoping for a quick resolution of the shutdown so he can go back to happily unwrapping the jobs report on the first Friday of every month.
We've got our fingers crossed, yeah.
Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Well, what is a good assessment of the economy, given that we've lost some visibility? We could, as Scott Horsley suggested, check in with the guy at the barbershop who seems to know everything, but the barbershop is not open this early, so we have called Mark Zandi, who is chief economist at Moody's Analytics and has been a guest many times here. Mr. Zandi, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be with you.
We don't know the employment numbers, obviously, but the outside estimates sound like they were not that great. How strong do you think the labor market is?
Not strong. I think it's struggling. Job growth has come to a virtual standstill in recent months. We're seeing some job growth in healthcare. We heard that in the previous report, hospitality, but we're losing jobs in manufacturing, construction, transportation, distribution, mining. So net-net, we're going nowhere fast. And the real problem is that businesses just aren't hiring. It feels like a hiring freeze across the economy, which is obviously very hard on younger people trying to get into the labor market. Businesses have cut back hours. That's the other way of kind of handling this. They've cut back temp jobs. So they've done everything but lay off, and that's key. The layoffs are the firewall between an economy that continues to grow and avoid recession, and that firewall has not been breached, so businesses aren't laying off. So hopefully that continues to happen, but everything else has, and the job market is struggling.
Are we doing this to ourselves, by which I mean the United States government is continuously, almost daily, changing tariff policies? There's a lot of uncertainty, and so businesses are standing still for that reason?
Yes. I think you can blame the tariff war and the impact that's had. I mean, in fact, you look at job growth, it was hanging in there pretty well right up till April. That's, of course, Liberation Day and the reciprocal tariffs, and since then, the job market has gone flat to down. And, of course, the highly restrictive immigration policy is having an impact as well. There's just no labor supply. The labor force, that's the number of people out there working, looking for work, that has gone completely flat over the past year as the foreign-born labor force declined. So you just simply can't create jobs in lots of industries where immigrants work. So Although those two policies are key.
I just mentioned, though, I mean, the theory was that was going to be good for domestic workers because there would be more demand for them. Is it not working out that way in the end?
No, we've not seen that. There's on net, the labor force has gone nowhere since this time last year. It's been flat. So seeing declines in foreign-born, a little bit increase in native-born, but that's typical. And the net of that is no labor force growth, which is very atypical, very unusual.
At what point does the shutdown become a drag on the economy? I assume not yet.
No, not yet. Assuming that there's no layoffs, I mean, there's a lot of conversation around that. If there's layoffs, big layoffs of government workers as a result of all this, then yeah, that's going to be a problem. But barring that, a shutdown of a week or two, no big deal. We've been down this path many times before. It's clearly a nuisance for the government workers that aren't on the job and not getting paid, but no big deal. If it extends beyond that, if it's 3-4 weeks, then it becomes a deal. It starts to become a real problem. Those government workers not getting paid have to make some hard choices. Contractors that are working with the government don't get their money. They're not doing business. If it lasts more than a month, that's a very big deal. And in the context of the very weak economy that we have right now, that would be the fodder for a recession.
I want to ask about another aspect of this, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics was in the news even before the jobs report disappeared today, as you know very well.
Right.
President Trump earlier this year didn't like a jobs report and some revisions of jobs reports, so he fired the Bureau of Labor Statistics director. He then nominated a conservative economist who was a much-debated choice. There was bipartisan opposition for a variety of reasons. The administration has now withdrawn that person, and now the numbers themselves have been disrupted. Given everything that's happened this year, should we believe what we hear whenever we do hear it from the government about statistics on the economy?
We should, but the quality of the data is eroding, no doubt about it. The survey responses were already falling well before all of this drama, but now they're, I'm sure, going to be way off because they're just not going to get done. We don't have the same number of folks at these agencies collecting the data. I mean, the Consumer Price Index is a good example. Yeah, if you go back to the beginning of the year, about 10% of the goods and services, prices for goods and services were imputed. You mean that they weren't being collected, they were determined by looking at other data.
Huh.
Now we're up to 35%. That gives you a sense of things. So, I trust the data as far as it goes, but the quality of the data is certainly eroding.
I think, as just a yes or no here, you're telling me more and more of the stats are a ballpark estimate rather than gathering hard information.
You got it. Exactly right.
Mark Zandi, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, anytime.
The Department of Energy says it's canceling more than $7 billion in funding for hundreds of clean energy projects. Office of Management and Budget Director Russ Vogt, called the funding being cut a, quote, green new scam. The states affected all voted for former Vice President Kamala Harris and her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Minnesota's on the list. Dana Ferguson with Minnesota Public Radio has more.
Governor Tim Walz took to his Capitol reception room yesterday morning to unpack how the federal government shutdown could hit home in Minnesota.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Like state governments around the country, Minnesota's preparing for possible ramifications of an extended shutdown. Thousands of federal workers here could be furloughed, and programs and services could be pared back. White House Budget Director Russ Vogt wrote on social media that the state, along with 15 others that backed former Vice President Kamala Harris's presidential bid last year, would see project funding cut. Harris beat Trump in the 2024 election here by more than 4 percentage points. U.S. Secretary of Energy Chris Wright said 223 projects were reviewed and, quote, did not adequately advance the nation's energy needs, were not economically viable, and would not provide a positive return on investment of taxpayer dollars, unquote. He didn't provide a list of projects affected in his announcement. Like governors in blue states around the country, Walz pushed back on the move and said it was politically motivated.
I think we've seen this, a vindictiveness, a willingness to try and target. And this whole idea that they see states as Democrats and Republicans, or they see areas as red or blue, is simply the most egregious violation of their oath to try and take care. You have a responsibility to give your best for people who vote against you. They don't see it this way.
And Walz said Minnesota was prepared to sue.
If we need to challenge in court, we'll challenge in court. But this idea that you've got to go and kiss the ring, or you've got to go and give some type of award to get basic services that he swore an oath to defend, that is outrageous.
DOE has not responded to a request for comment on Walz's claim that this is a purely political move. Award grantees affected will have 30 days to appeal, according to the Energy Department. For NPR News, I'm Dana Ferguson in St. Paul.
This is NPR News.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
R comes from this station. And from Progressive, Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The trial of Sean Combs was marked by explosive allegations and graphic evidence against the hip-hop mogul. Today, it is at its final stage. Combs has been in custody for over a year and is appearing in a New York City courtroom for a sentencing hearing. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has been covering this all along, and she joins us now. And before we get started, a warning that we're going to mention sexual abuse and violence in this conversation. Good morning, Isabella.
Good morning, Layla.
So let's just get an overview. What was Combs charged with?
Right. Well, basically, the government accused Combs of running a criminal organization that enabled and concealed a pattern of sexual and physical abuse for decades. The bulk of their case was really centered on the allegations of two of Combs' ex-girlfriends, the singer Cassie Ventura and a woman who testified using the pseudonym Jane. They both said that Combs used violence and manipulation to pressure them into drug-fueled sexual encounters with male escorts for years. And the prosecution spent nearly 6 weeks presenting its case. Crowds of people flocked to the courthouse every single day to watch the proceedings. And in July, the jury decided on a split verdict.
Okay, so that's what he was accused of. He faced several charges in relation to that. What was he convicted for?
Well, so the jury acquitted Combs of the most serious charges, which were sex trafficking and racketeering, but he was convicted on two counts of transportation for prostitution, which basically means he was found guilty of transporting Ventura, Jane, and hired escorts across state lines for the purpose of engaging in commercial sex. Each charge carries a maximum of 10 years, so he could potentially be looking at a total of 2 decades in prison.
And what is the government recommending as a sentence?
Federal prosecutors requested that the judge sentence Combs to no less than 11 years and 3 months. Their letter cited his pattern of violence towards his ex-girlfriends. You may remember one of the key pieces of evidence in this case was a hotel security video of Combs knocking Ventura to the ground, kicking and hitting her.
Yeah.
Ahead of today's sentencing, she filed a victim impact statement to the judge, and she said that she still carries the scars from that abuse, and she fears for her safety if Combs was to be released.
And I imagine the defense is asking for a much lighter sentence. What are they saying?
That's correct. So Combs' attorneys have asked that he be sentenced to no more than 14 months. Combs has been in a Brooklyn jail since his arrest last September, like you mentioned. So with that time already served, that would mean he could go home before the end of 2025. Yesterday, he filed a letter to the judge expressing his remorse over the domestic violence and asking for a second chance. And there was also another ex-girlfriend of his who wrote to the judge. She was originally listed as a victim in the government's indictment. She didn't end up testifying. And in her letter, she wrote that she doesn't feel like a victim, and she advocated for Combs to be allowed to go home to his family.
And what do you expect to hear in court today?
Well, notably, Combs decided that he wasn't going to testify in his trial, but he may give an allocution statement today, which is, you know, typically an opportunity for a defendant to express remorse over their actions. During the trial, the defense also didn't call any witnesses. You know, they only took about 30 minutes to present their case and then rested, which, remember, the prosecution took 6 weeks.
Wow.
But for today's hearing, several defense attorneys are hoping to speak, and this time they'll have to make their case to a judge, not a jury.
That's NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
It's Friday, which is when we hear from StoryCorps. Mark Gaskin worked on the roads of Colorado as a traffic controller, sort of like an air traffic controller, except you're overseeing the highways of Colorado. After being injured on the job, he was unable to work and eventually lost his home. Today, Mark lives out of his car, parked outside the apartment where his elderly aunt lives. Mark is her main caretaker, and he told his sister, Deborah Ayo, how he became the person his aunt needed most.
In July of last year, her account had gotten hacked.
I remember.
I didn't find out until her rent was due that she had $12 in her account. I went to the office when she got her first notice of eviction, and I told them, I said, there's no way my aunt's going to live on the streets, and handed over my debit card. I don't have extra money, but without hesitation, I paid her rent. I didn't want my aunt, this 81-year-old woman, trying to live the way I was living my life, sleeping in my car, having to go to rec centers to shower, going to food banks to eat.
In reality, as a homeless person, you helped Auntie not to be homeless.
I'm glad I was able to show her that our relationship goes beyond finances. It's just love. Cleaning up the house, doing laundry, taking her shopping. Even if she doesn't want to buy anything, but she just wants to get out of the house, that's what I do. And she's always asking, well, does it bother me? I told her, I says, no. I says, this is what I'm here for.
Where do you think we learned how to take care of our elders?
Growing up, I remember Mom, she doesn't have a car. She has 9 kids. Her parents lived 5 miles away. So in order for her to take care of her parents, she had to pack us up, walk the 5 miles to go visit them, take care of their everyday needs. And then we'd have to walk back. You know, it's tough right now because my situation, living out of my car, but it doesn't change my duty as a member of this family.
I can truly say that I am so pleased with the way you have taken care of Auntie. Should anything happen today and she passes, when you lay your head down at night, you've done all that you can do. You did your best with what was given to you.
Before, you know, I was doing so good. I had a great job, had a 2-bedroom house, my own private yard. Now, all that's gone. But I'm okay with that because the joy that I get from knowing that Auntie's taken care of, it's worth it for me.
Mark Gaskin and his sister Deborah Ayo. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at subaru.com/pets. And from Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
Daniel Day-Lewis has not been living alone in the woods for 20 years, but his newest character has. The actor unretired to star in his son's debut feature film.
I thought, I wonder if we can cook something up just for the pure pleasure of working together.
I'm Elsa Chang. Father and son talk about their film, Anemone, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. We are People Powered. Your host Your local host this afternoon is Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It's 529. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks so much for tuning in on this October 3rd. It's hard to know the date since we are expecting 82 to 85 across our region. And tonight, even pretty warm, mid to upper 60s. By tomorrow, Saturday, we're looking at mostly sunny skies with highs in the mid to upper 80s. Coming up, we're going to enjoy a little bit of music from Sam Miltich. We'll also be telling you throughout our morning about all of the events going on throughout our region. Coming up before 8 o'clock and then until 8:30, we'll talk sports. It'll go from soccer to the Lynx to the Vikings to the Twins and all kinds of things in between. Text us at 218-326-1234. Miltich and Dave Carr with Autumn in New York. Time now for John Latimer and our Daily Dose of Nature.
On today's date, October 3rd, 1985, common blackberries began to show some color. The blackberries are a magnificent plant to study in the fall because they carry some of the most beautiful colors that you can imagine. They go from green to orange to red to a very deep, deep burgundy, and they keep those leaves on for quite a while, long after all the other leaves are off. You will still continue to see the beautiful leaves of the common blackberry. I would highly recommend that if you have blackberries, if you've been picking blackberries this summer and you have blackberries that you know the location of, you should probably take the time here in October to get out and give them a good looking over.
For NPR News, I'm Jeanette Didios in Santa Fe.
The Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, was named the Archbishop of Canterbury today. She becomes the first woman to lead the Church of England in its 1,400-year history. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. President Trump has made the determination that the United States is in an armed conflict with unspecified drug cartels. That's according to a document obtained by NPR that the administration sent to Congress about its military strikes on boats in the Caribbean. It says we're carrying drugs. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is with us in studio this morning to talk about this. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so what is this document? And what does it say?
So this is a notification that was sent to Congress by the administration as required by law. NPR obtained a copy of it. And what it purports to do is lay out a bit more of a legal justification for the administration's military strikes, as you said, against suspected drug boats over the past month. It says the president is taking action under his Article 2 powers as commander-in-chief and in self-defense. That we have heard from the administration before. What's interesting here is that it says the president has determined the cartels are non-state armed groups, that the U.S. is in a non-international armed conflict with them, and that the Pentagon is conducting operations against them under the laws of armed conflict.
Okay, so before this document came out, you spoke to a lot of experts on this, legal experts, foreign policy experts, who all called these strikes illegal extrajudicial killings. So does this letter change things, give legal cover here?
I wouldn't go that far, no. Legal experts say there are still a lot of holes, a lot of issues with the powers the president is asserting with this. Here's Brian Finucane. He's a national security lawyer and expert with the International Crisis Group.
What this boils down to is the president of the United States asserting a prerogative to kill people based solely on his own say-so.
So yes, there are more legal terms here, non-state armed groups engaged in a non-international armed conflict with the U.S. And that, Finucane says, in essence, echoes the legal framework that the U.S. worked under in the post-9/11 war on terror. But Finucane says the facts were very different then. Al-Qaeda killed some 3,000 people on 9/11. Congress authorized the use of military force against an actual armed group, Al-Qaeda. And none of that applies in the context of the drug cartels. Finucane says the facts just do not support the idea or the legal conclusion that the U.S. is in an armed conflict with narco-trafficking groups.
Outside of armed conflict, there is a word for the premeditated killing of people, and that word is murder. And just because the administration puts together this fig leaf of a legal justification does not legitimize these premeditated killings in the Caribbean.
Okay, so what has the administration said about exactly what happened in the strikes?
Well, they have said that they've blown up three suspected drug boats so far. In the first strike, the president said 11 members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua were killed. The administration has provided no evidence that the people on the boat were indeed Tren de Aragua, or that there were drugs on the boat, or that the boat posed a direct threat to the United States. Trump was asked by reporters at the White House after the second strike about providing proof. Here's what he said.
We have proof. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was, like, it's spattered all over the ocean. Big bags of cocaine and fentanyl all over the place.
Now, the administration didn't provide anything for us to see, those big bags of cocaine and fentanyl all over the ocean. Trump did say they have recorded evidence, but he didn't elaborate. Now, White House spokesperson Anna Kelly said yesterday the president has acted in line with the law of armed conflict and is making good on his promise to take on cartels. But again, the administration hasn't provided any evidence publicly that would support these claims. And legal experts say even then, trafficking drugs has never been considered combat or direct participation in hostilities, which means legally, these narco-traffickers are considered civilians and not people who can be lethally targeted like they have been.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you for your reporting, Ryan.
Thank you.
This is a deeply interesting segment of the program, getting updated on national security here, because we next hear about Ukrainian drone strikes. Ukrainian drones are inflicting significant damage on oil refineries deep inside Russia, and the Trump administration has been hinting that it may be willing to help. NPR's Greg Myrie is covering this. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so first, how is Ukraine able to carry out these longer and longer range attacks?
Well, Ukraine's drones now reach hundreds of miles inside Russia, and the main target has been oil refineries, which they strike at night, mostly in southern and western Russia. These set off huge fireballs in the night sky. You see the evidence all over social media, though the Russians aren't saying much about them. In some cases, it appears the refineries are knocked offline, but hard to tell how quickly they're being repaired. Ukraine has carried out about 25 such strikes in August and September against some of the country's largest refineries, which produce gasoline, used by civilians and diesel used by the military.
25 strikes. I'd heard about a few of these, but I appreciate you pulling it all together. Now, let me ask what the United States' attitude is toward this. I know the president in recent days has changed his tone toward Ukraine. He seems much more positive. But is the U.S. changing the aid it provides?
Well, not so far, but there are a couple possibilities here. First, the Trump administration says it's considering Ukraine's request for Tomahawk missiles. Now, these are powerful, accurate, and travel much further than any other weapons the U.S. has provided. We should stress no decision has been made, and there are questions about whether the U.S. has sufficient stockpiles. Second, the Wall Street Journal has reported that Trump has agreed to increase intelligence sharing with Ukraine to focus on Russian energy sites. The CIA and others are not commenting. Now, here in Washington, Andrew Weiss at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says Trump can't just threaten Russia. He really would need to take action.
The Russian position on Ukraine has not budged one inch. And Donald Trump is obviously very frustrated about that. But simply putting on Twitter that you're possibly going to help Ukraine in various ways is not the same as actually helping Ukraine.
And now in Russia, President Vladimir Putin says that if Ukraine does get Tomahawks, that could lead to a, quote, whole new level of escalation.
Greg, I would have imagined that Russia, having had generations to prepare for attack, thinking about potential American attack, as a matter of fact, would be ready with strong air defenses. Why are they having so much trouble defending against these drones and possibly other things?
Well, Russia is the largest country in the world, and that means massive resources, oil, gas, and minerals. But it also means it's very hard to defend everywhere. And these Russian refineries were out of range previously or weren't being targeted and didn't need to be defended. Now, suddenly, they're vulnerable with relatively little protection. So Russian civilians are facing higher gas prices. We're seeing long lines in a number of places at gas stations in regions throughout Russia.
Wow, so it's affecting civilians. Is it affecting the Russian military?
At this point, no. Russia produces a huge amount of diesel, more than enough for the military. Again, here's Andrew Weiss.
The Russian military runs on diesel. Russia produces twice as much diesel annually as it needs and exports the rest.
So Russia has a cushion when it comes to diesel for the military, but we are seeing strains on Russia's economy overall. Economic growth this year is expected to be just 1%.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Steve.
This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. Coming up, we will be bringing you more news from Morning Edition. KEXE started without federal funding in 1976, and today, nearly 50 years later, we find ourselves in the same place again. This is a powerful reminder that this station has always been people-powered, and today, that need is even greater. You can join us now. Thank you for all of you who have done it already. Go to kaxe.org. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, a boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346. So much going on in our region. It is First Friday. That means there are events at art centers and in downtowns around our region. That includes tonight at Watermark Art Center with Kristen Anderson, and there's also downtown Grand Rapids, lots of events going on. McCroskey Arts Center will be joining us. Katie Marshall coming up before 9 o'clock to talk about what's happening with First Friday and their brand new exhibit. Also tomorrow, there are artist tours with the McCroskey Arts Center Fall Studio Tour. There's also a 9th annual Monarch Butterfly Festival Saturday at the Bemidji Veterans Home on Ann Street. And you can also catch the Iron Range Pasty Festival this Saturday, 4 to 7 at Mountain Iron Community Center.
You should give as you are able because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support.
Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The WNBA Finals tip off tonight. Normally, the series between... Excuse me, I don't know why I got confused here. Normally, the series between the Las Vegas Aces and the Phoenix Mercury would be the biggest story in the league. But instead, a controversy has taken over. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is here to talk it through. Hi, Becky.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what's this controversy about?
So basically the other day, a player named Nafisa Collier had this end-of-season press conference where she unleashed this, like, very strident, pointed criticism of league leadership and especially of Commissioner Kathy Engelbert. So Collier talked about a bunch of issues that have been simmering for a long time, things like referees and pay for players and leadership just not listening to concerns. And it's, you know, it's important because this is a very prominent player. She's the star for the Minnesota Lynx. She's a many-time All-Star. This year, she was voted the second most valuable player in the league. And she's just, like, really respected. She's very calm. She's very smart. And so for her to go scorched earth like this is a very big deal.
Okay, so tell me more about what she said and why it's caused such a stir.
Well, I think it's caused a stir because the criticisms of the commissioner were very direct and personal. And so Collier said she had tried raising these concerns in private conversations with Engelbert. It hadn't gone anywhere. I'll play you a little clip of what Collier said. She is recalling sitting down with the commissioner earlier this year and pressing her about the league's very low pay for these young stars like Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, Paige Beckers, who have brought with them these massive fan bases. Here's
her response was... Caitlin should be grateful she makes $16 million off the court, because without the platform that the WNBA gives her, she wouldn't make anything. And in that same conversation, she told me, players should be on their knees thanking their lucky stars for the media rights deal that I got them. That's a mentality driving our league from the top. We go to battle every day to protect a shield that doesn't value us.
Wow, wow.
Yeah, so you get a little flavor of that. Engelbert, in response, she put out a statement. She said she was disheartened by Collier's remarks. She said she has utmost respect for WNBA players. She's committed to the future of them in the league. But this pay issue especially is the very biggest tension at the heart of the league right now. These low salaries for players that predate the boom in attention. Now the league is bringing in all this new revenue. The league salary for those players that I mentioned, like Caitlin Clark, is about $80,000. So anyway, it's not surprising that there has been a lot of voice or a lot of support voiced for Collier this week from other players.
So that's hanging over the finals. Game one is tonight. Yeah. How are players on the two teams talking about what Collier said?
Yeah, well, of course, they were asked about it. It's the biggest story of the WNBA right now. So the Las Vegas star, Asia Wilson, she said she was, quote, disgusted by Collier's account of what Engelbert said. Both teams do say they're trying to focus on the games, obviously. Here's guard Kalia Copper from the Phoenix Mercury.
We are standing behind Fee. We are in heavy support of everything that has to do with the league, because this is a really big year. But just right now, we are really locked in.
And actually, just to follow up on that, she calls it a big year. Part of that is that the union contract between the players and the league expires later this month, and that is now shaping up to be a big fight, too.
Okay, before I let you go, though, you have to tell me about what to expect in the games themselves.
Yeah, it's a best of seven series. That's a first for the WNBA. It used to just be five. The Aces are led by Asia Wilson. She's a four-time MVP. The Mercury are back in the finals for the first time in a few years after adding this duo of all-star forwards in Satu Sabali and Alyssa Thomas to their roster. Two really great teams. They played four times this regular season. Vegas won three of those times, so it's not surprising that they're the favorites, but I think anything can happen over the course of seven games.
That's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music is inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Leila Faldel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
Federal government means no September jobs report today. We'll try an instrument landing instead.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com. And by TrebiPay, a managed B2B payments platform for global brands, offering zero-touch AR plus tools to help reduce DSO at TrebiPay.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The partial government shutdown now means that two of the top five most important readouts on the economy will not come out today as scheduled. It's the freshest count of the number of people on payrolls and the separate unemployment rate. It would have covered the month just ended, September. We assigned my colleague Samantha Fields to use whatever other data is available to piece together an approximation.
No one does jobs data quite like the BLS.
We do have private data to look at, and that is meaningful.
Mark Hamrick at Bankrate says it can't replace government data, but reports from private companies, including payroll processing firm ADP and outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas, do give us glimpses into the labor market.
Those data points, I think, are very consistent with what we've been seeing otherwise, and that is this is a low-hire, low-fire job market.
Seeing the latest private data has only made Angela Hanks at the Century Foundation more curious about the government data, though.
So, for example, when I see that ADP is predicting that we're going to have lost 32,000 jobs in September, it's certainly cause for concern. But I think my curiosity is, what are we missing from that report, and what more do we need to know about the health of the labor market that's not captured here?
The Chicago Fed has just come out with a new analysis of the labor market that pulls together nearly a dozen different sources of data in one place. It'll come out twice a month and include federal data, unemployment claims, and the jobs report when available, private data from companies including Indeed and Morning Consult, and Google search activity on unemployment. Scott Brave at the Chicago Fed says for September,
we see a little bit less job finding going on. We see a little bit more job loss. But on balance, not a whole lot has changed.
Including the unemployment rate. The Chicago Fed estimates it's still right around 4.3%. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Markets Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all up in the 0.3% range now. Firefighters in Southern California here quickly contained a fire following an explosion at a Chevron oil refinery in the city of El Segundo last night. There was a massive fireball, but no injuries. It's It's not clear how this will affect operations or gas prices. The average price of gas is $4.64 a gallon in California, 47% above the national average. The oil industry highlights gas taxes, but economists say lack of refinery capacity is a large part of that higher retail price.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And by MarketWatch. From housing prices to inflation, the market is uncertain. MarketWatch has tools to help navigate the road ahead. MarketWatch, don't short yourself.
Napoleon Bonaparte supposedly called England a nation of shopkeepers. It was meant as an insult. On this side of the pond, we like to embrace entrepreneurship. Northwestern University economist Lewis Kahn's line is, what became the United States of America was born of entrepreneurship. There's new research suggesting we've been missing a lot of entrepreneurs when we try to count them up. Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell has been reading into this. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, David.
Where'd they find these, I don't know, hidden entrepreneurs?
Well, David, there's just been this surge in non-employer businesses, you know, businesses without payroll employees. And these include independent contractors, freelancers, moonlighters, and other solopreneurs. And while tens of millions of people are engaged in this kind of self-employment, they're often missed. They're absent from the statistics on labor market trends and business dynamism.
All right, but not all these, for instance, solopreneurs, as you put it, operate under the radar. I mean, there's data on businesses without employees, of course. Yet, I'm getting the impression we could do better getting a deeper sense of this vital part of the economy.
There's a recent paper by a handful of scholars, and it's an ongoing effort, David, to create a comprehensive database for the Census Bureau on self-employment. Their investigation is nuanced, it's complex, but this finding stood out. There were 33 million people engaged in some form of self-employment in 2019. Now, in sharp contrast, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has calculated a total of 15.3 million self-employed in 2019, so half the new results.
Yeah, I mean, let's repeat that number. The title of the paper is Business Owners and the Self-Employed, 33 Million and Counting.
So perhaps one of these overlooked entrepreneurs is Kalik Rogers. He's founder of Minneapolis-based Good Riddance Consulting. And his for-profit consulting business mostly works on, you know, convening, gathering different groups together to design strategies to help build community and address common problems.
I work with city, government, county level, private business, people that want to go from good to great, or businesses that have good intentions but don't always have an intended impact.
So one project Good Riddance worked on led to the Minnesota Housing Agency funding school district programs where students learn the construction trades while building homes for low-income residents or Minnesotans who have been experiencing homelessness.
So what we do at Good Riddance is curate that environment and that space to bring those stakeholders collectively together to create an outcome and a solution that is measurable, that is feasible to implement and practical.
And what you see, it's not just one venture. People tend to have portfolios of ventures.
Yeah, that's one of the striking numbers that comes out of this study. Self-employed, they operate multiple enterprises at the same time. For example, Rogers, that we just heard from, he runs a nonprofit, Catalyst for Systems Change, that works on youth development. So these data sets are really fascinating. And what these economists are developing is a more nuanced picture of the many ways entrepreneurship plays out in America.
Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell is in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, David.
Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our digital team includes Antoinette Brock, Emily McCune, and Dylan Mietinen. Our engineers are Rachel Breeze and Tessa Block. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Thanks for joining us on People Powered KAXE. We're getting updates from Morning Edition from National Public Radio. We're also going to be bringing you local news an hour from now, the newest Up North report. So much local news at our website. You can check out, you can read more. There's extended stories of the headlines that you hear on the Up North Report. And that includes things like Minnesota's history of the since departed woodland caribou. We've also got stories about Kutaska hosting costume drive for Grand Rapids and International Falls, and updates on how Attorney General of Minnesota Keith Ellison will be hosting a community forum in Bemidji on October 7th. It's all available at kaxe.org. We receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their Energy Forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids. Aiken Hibbing.